Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. One of the things that many of us do, and you just mentioned that I didn't know you had set up standing searches, and you have one that was just on the word reliability.
And yes,
I saw a question just the other day, and it was It was on, I think it was on Quora, and it was the weirdest question. It was, how does a small sample size affect the reliability? It was, you know, like,
how does a small sample size affect reliability?
Right.
Sample size in testing or
I mean, they use the word sample size, sample, right? So
right.
From just the generic thing is that means that implies that you can't evaluate or test everything, the whole population. So you take a sample, a subset, and you're going to try to do some measurement or test or evaluation or something on that subset to draw a conclusion about what the whole population would be like. That's why we use samples, right? And
yes.
So there's not more, the whole question was just that one line. And so I thought,
right.
So I said, okay, there's two ways to answer this. One of them is based on the common language definition of reliability, which is trustworthiness. And so the first person that answered this question answered it in that vein, saying, well, if you have a small sample size versus a large sample size, it means that the sample it's going to have more uncertainty whether it is representative of the whole population. So the confidence bounds would be larger. The margin of error on a survey, for example, is larger, right? It just means that we took a sample and we don't really know a lot about the overall population, but we think it's kind of in this area. Where if you do a large sample, you can say, we're pretty sure that this is the right value. This is real close to the true value.
And to be sure, Fred, you want to say that, I mean, obviously it's the ratio of your samples that you're observing to the samples that are out there that you don't have any, you know, in other words, the ratio of samples to the entire fielded population, the samples you're looking at versus the field, right? If it's a, you know, you've got 10 unit or you're a very low volume production company and you only make 1,000 a year, and you're testing 100 of those, then the ratio is quite significant, 10% of them.
Careful there.
Is that right?
No, statistics-wise, it's not really that overall ratio. There's a bunch of other factors that fit into this thing.
Okay.
But in general, when you take a sample and you measure just, say, average, you know, put the button press force on a button, and you only take a small sample, there's so many variables in that, but the idea is that the more samples you have, and at some point there's a diminishing return, right? Over, say, 100 samples, there's not a lot information gained by doing 101 samples, independent of how big the population is. But there's still other things to consider. But the idea is that if I only take one sample, and there's an equal chance that I could pick any sample in the population. It's just, we have to assume that we can do a random sample. It might be right on the middle, right? And there's a 68% chance if it was normally distributed, whatever the things we were measuring, it's pretty close to the middle. But there's a 32% chance it's not. It could be outlier. And then we think that's the average, but it's really not. So more samples then gives you a higher chance that if you're measuring an average, for example, it'll be pretty close to that. So the chance of getting stuff that are all outliers on one side goes down pretty rapidly as you get up to 25, 30 samples. Now, that's one way to answer that question, because that's the common definition in the language of reliability is, can I trust this? Is the sample giving me a true representation of what's going on? Can I trust
the whole population?
Right. That's one way to think of it. The other way to think of it is that No, the sample size is immaterial to what the actual reliability performance of the product is. The product is going to perform as it's going to perform, and it doesn't matter how many samples I measure, it's going to be what it is. If I sample a small sample set, I'm either going to get an answer that's pretty close to the actual one or something that's not very close to the actual one. But if I make a decision based on that to change the product or don't detect a big issue or big field problem, it doesn't actually change the actual design reliability, what it actually is, unless I use that information to make a change, right? So if you think of a reliability as its performance over time with the customer in the customer's hands, right? The proportion that survived for 2 years, for example, in some environment, that doesn't change no matter how many samples I use. We may understand it better with more samples or not understand it very well with small samples, but that doesn't actually change the value.
Doesn't change the value of
the actual product reliability. The actual performance of that system doesn't change if I'm just measuring a small sample versus a large sample.
Okay. I'm not sure I'm following where. Yeah.
Well, let's say I'm designing.
If you tested three and you're making 1,000, you know, and I said, well, yeah, we tested three and they all lasted, you know, this X hours under these conditions. And then, you know, this is a, you know, depending on the use of that product.
Yeah. The 1,000.
I kind of understand how well if that the three that they tested, what were the conditions, how much variation.
But that doesn't, you go through all that testing. So it doesn't change the fundamental design of your product. Right now, which is different than HALT. If I take two samples into HALT and I find a bunch of stuff and then I ignore that, right? I don't change anything. Those defects are still there in our production.
Right.
Right. And they're going to be there at whatever proportion they're going to be. Right.
Right.
That's what I mean is that if I go do a life test and I run them for 1,000 hours or do whatever, or do some accelerated test on 20 samples, I'll get an answer. Right. And I may go, oh, that's okay. But it also has that other kind of uncertainty of, well, it was just a sample and it could be more or less than what we're thinking it is. But unless you use that information to, like in HALT, to actually go redesign the product or change the product or, you know, do something to it to make it more robust.
That's what it's going
to be. It's going to be what it is going to be.
Exactly. If you don't do anything to change it, it's going to be what it's going to be. And if you had three samples and one failed and you decided, well, you investigated and found that this one had some kind of variation of manufacturing that caused it to fail, and you don't go fix the manufacturing problem or redesign it so you can't have that manufacturing problem, you're going to get a third failing. I mean,
well, that's our number. That's our best estimate at that point.
Yeah, gross estimate is 1 out of 3 is going to fail.
Right.
And, you know, 30% is for some products. I've heard, you know, I know in the biomedical equipment field, I've heard as high as 50%.
Yeah, I've been in acceptable. That field. Yeah. For whatever reason. It wasn't acceptable for long.
But 30% won't be acceptable. And then I, you know, go argue with the guy, say, well, you know, you could reduce this by testing. He says, yeah, but that would affect my product.
Private line, and man, we have to ship it later.
Cycle time. Yeah. And I don't get paid for reliability.
That's right.
For how quickly I can manufacture this. And I go, yep, this is a fundamental problem. So, right. But yes.
Here's another thing, though. There's another question that came up. And I know you saw this question. And it was related, in part, it was related to one of the things I thought was just odd was they said, well, we do a lot of testing and you guys have often talked about test to failure, you know, and go do this stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, that only gets, if you only test to failure, that only finds failure mechanisms that are wear out stuff. How, and most of the testing, no, right. That was part of that comment. And another part of it was, is that, when I do MTBF testing, which I have all kinds of problems with, I test a bunch of samples for a certain amount of hours and accumulate hours, and then I can estimate MTBF. And then the question went on to, what do I do with early life failures or infant mortality type failures? And I was like, okay, there's so many issues here. But the idea is, when we test a failure, I don't think we're talking about wear out mechanisms all the time. We're talking about lack of margin for the stresses applied. We're talking about manufacturing defects or latent errors or design flaws, which they may or may not be mechanisms that are we classically call wear out.
Right. But Fred, let me stop you there for just a second. One of the key things that I think that is overlooked in HALT testing or in stress margin testing, and that is comparative analysis, comparison between margins of samples.
Yeah.
Okay. That, I believe, if you have three samples, two of them operate to 95 degrees C with no problem. Operating limit. And say this is a digital board. We know that it's not going to probably blow up. I can repeat that.
Yeah,
I can repeat that. But then we get another sample that only goes to 65. That third sample goes to 65 and fails.
Yeah,
there is gold. That's where you're saying, okay, I know that through this random sampling of got three, let's hope for you different lots or whatever, different mixed builds, and you say this one is gonna have a real risk if this margin is reduced during manufacturing or by any kind of change in the component, that it's going to be into the, range that is going to start causing operational failure. Probably not going to hard fail. It's probably going to just be intermittently lockup or something like that. Right. It could be in a
digital
system.
Which from a customer's point of view, and depending on their product, could be pretty serious. Or not
really bad, right? Really bad because they've relied on it. It works most of the time, but sometime during a process, it could just start to block up, and you throw a batch of whatever you're processing away.
Isn't that called a Microsoft operating system? No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. I don't want to hear from those guys.
Well, I was going to respond to you. I was going to respond to one of your things. You posted something about a Mac and how you had to reboot Windows. I know. You haven't used Windows in a long time, maybe. Right. I don't know.
I'm still scarred. I'm still scarred.
I know. They've gotten better. Let me just say.
I'm sure they have. All right. So we go back to this guy's question. He's thinking that, test of failure really only goes after wear out type stuff, and that he does separate testing to estimate the flat part of the curve.
No, I don't agree with that. It doesn't. Testing to failure is hard to do in anything but an accelerated environment. I mean, again, technological obsolescence, the inherent intrinsic wear out modes in semiconductors and other components used in the manufacturing of or in a system of electronics. Except for electrolytic capacitors, maybe, or some others, have extensive lives that are long beyond the technological obsolescence or the useful life of the product. And so we see that all the time.
But if we have a contaminated system or somebody sticks their finger on it, we have a trace, shorting out and stuff like, even though that it's corrosion, let's say a contaminated board, that's corrosion. Right. That's a classic wear out mechanism, but it doesn't end. It doesn't wait 5 years to do it. It has all the right conditions and it happens pretty quickly. It happens within a week or two. So I have a hard time with that, the bathtub curve. And I know you've wrote a great article about
there's a drain in the bathtub curve and you'll see it on Accendo.
Right.
It's been posted.
But the idea is that it was at one point I thought it was just a requirement, unwritten requirement that you always did a presentation and you showed the bathtub curve. And it was like, the more I've learned and the more I've had more experience I've gotten, it's like that is not serving us well. I think the idea is that you learn from failures and you can roughly classify them where they are in this academically created bathtub, but it doesn't really change anything. I need to understand the failure I need to understand what circumstances lead for it to occur and what can I do about it. And
absolutely,
it doesn't matter whether it's a wear out or not. If it wears out in 3 minutes, that's still a problem.
Right. You know? Yeah. Well, if it's, you know, it's again, classifying something as wear out, like you say, corrosion. Okay. That could be, you know, battery terminals, things like that. All the time, but a lot of times it's like, one of the problems with encapsulating a board is if it's not properly cleaned, before encapsulation, yeah, you may trap a contaminant.
Yeah.
Well, that's not necessarily really a design. I wouldn't call that something inherent to the design, but inherent to the manufacturing process that wasn't really considered or controlled. I mean, right. If the cleaning was really thorough, then you don't have a problem with, you might get a benefit of encapsulation techniques. And, right. But you've got to also balance that with the fact that you will trap contaminants if it's not absolute. And depending on where those contaminants are, over a trace or near some kind of lead that's very small, and everything's real small now.
That's right.
So, yeah, so it doesn't take much. But so that's kind of the thing that, yeah, as you said, it's absolutely the most critical thing in testing is analyzing what happened and what was going on, whether you had a decline in a function, say that it, again, I go to say comparison of margins and comparison of operating, mm-hmm, limits. If you start having high bit error rates as you get up in temperature, and you two of your five samples have excellent, you know, very low bit error rates, even at 130 C or something like that, then, you know, your rests are really high. You can compare those things and you can start to investigate what actual component or element in that device is causing the most variation. And once you start to focus on that, you really maybe yield some benefits in proving that. And, you know, I think that's happened with the phones getting more water resistant. Everything's, mm-hmm, been, you know, over time, they said, could we take that headphone connector, that 3.5 millimeter headphone connector, and make it a little more waterproof? Yes, we can. Mm-hmm. You know, Bluetooth headsets make that possible now.
Yeah.
And everybody's really using that. Nobody wants to use wired things. So,
I do.
You know,
I'm that outlier guy again.
Okay. You've never been tangled up in wires. Okay.
Well, I do all the time. I put the phone cord, the cord, yeah, down my shirt and put the phone in my pocket when I'm out in the garden or chopping wood or doing stuff like that, just so it doesn't get tangled.
Not having a plugged in cord helps the user not get tangled up, but it helps the reliability of the phone, because there's been more than once where somebody's pulled on a cord,
yep,
and it pulled the phone out of their pocket onto the concrete.
Well, I'm sure that has never happened in your house. That's just, you don't know that from experience, do you? Being a little facetious. Yeah. So I made a note for the title of this. I said MTBF reliability and the curve. And two out of those three, I don't like very much anymore. And you know,
well, good. MTBF you've had established long, and you have made a excellent case on MTBF, the other website you have, for much longer than you've had Accendo.
Oh yeah,
and so I agree, and I like to hear when I listen to your other talk how you all emphasize testing and root cause analysis and looking at field data and those kinds of things that to me are fundamental to the whole thing, and not, you know, using a bunch of prediction or cookbooks. That's really fundamental to the engineers today moving forward with reliability. And again, the best way to become a reliability engineer is study unreliability. First thing you do to get in any company, try and get them to open, and you will find it very hard, because a lot of them are assignable causes. Some of those people that caused it or overlooked it are still there at the company, and they sure don't want to talk about those bad memories. That's a challenge. That's part of a challenge. But
if you're facing one of these challenges, if you're listening to this, and just as Kirk summarized it, is, you know, if you're facing one of these challenges, let us know. What are the things that you're running into? And we, that probably make an excellent mm-hmm. follow-up episode for what we're talking about now. But we'd also like just to help if we can. We'll give you a response. You can find us at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a comment form there for you. Or you can get a hold of us through our about pages. We have our contact information and stuff. I'm doing my senior moment here, Kirk. LinkedIn is another place right. You can find us. And we do pull questions from all those sources, and people get in touch with us for one reason or another. And I hope it's in part because we spend 20 seconds saying, hey, please do get in touch with us. It makes our topic list just grow and have lots of interesting things to talk about.
But I also want to say there's a lot more information in Ascendo Reliability, and we've got lots of written articles. Fred has courses. There's just all kinds of new information and old information. For how many years? 6 years
we've been doing this? It's been 6 years now in Ascendo. Yeah.
So if you can't find it, boy, let us know, because we really want to know some new, we'd love to hear any new questions.
Yeah. Or even old questions. We can point you even to an article. We just keeps us current. Keeps us young. Right, Kirk?
I'm trying.
All right. So I'm still waiting for that update on the blender. So last I heard it was up to 3 cycles. So.
Yeah. we'll go run another smoothie and see if we can, kill it.
Detect anything. Yeah. Do you time how long it takes to blend to your satisfaction? No. Controlled experimental stuff?
We have a big lack of data and use conditions.
You're not doing the density of the carrots or the ice or anything like that?
No, or how many rocks were thrown in there, or cold the chocolate drops were when they were crushed up.
Oh, man. Yeah. You got to get a handle on this, Kirk. I thought you were an engineer.
Okay.
We'll look forward to the update, Kirk. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.